This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Want to become the sort of developer top rail shops like Thoughtbot fight over? Join Upcase today to get the pro training, insider knowledge, access to Thoughtbot developers, and a community of like-minded learners you need. Hone core skills like Vim, Tmux, Git, and Rails by visiting upcase.com/halfoff to get 50% off your first month of Upcase. Let's get that junior out of your title and start leveling up today with Upcase.
All right, so welcome to the special edition live bike shed with our...
We've closed the doors. We have a captive audience.
Yes. And they've been locked behind you, by the way, just FYI. So thanks for coming on, Sandy, our special guest.
Delighted to be here.
Well.
Start, Derek.
Our first episode we ever did, which is like 65 episodes or so ago, we talked about our experiences using the Sandy Metz's rules, using Sandy Metz's rules on a project. And it still remains, I think, our like most popular episode. And it's part of Thoughtbot's like concerted effort to make it seem like you work at Thoughtbot. and we're doing a pretty good job at that because I see people being like, Thoughtbot's Sandy Metz. I'm like, yeah, it's working.
I have seen that myself.
If you did work at Thoughtbot, I think your job title would just be Sandy Metz.
I'm sure you get asked about, like, are the rules like the number one question you get asked about at podcasts? It wasn't even in, like, so practical...
Object-oriented design.
Okay,
in Ruby.
Practical object-oriented
design.
No, they weren't. In that book. It just came out of like an interview for that book.
I gave those rules. Okay, here I am. I need a timer. You know that, because I can go on and on and on. So I'll try to be concise here. I was helping a company in San Francisco doing a little consulting gig. They had the classic many things too big problem, many things too connected problem. They had a lot of like 5,000 line active record models. And so a lot of controllers that knew everything, a lot of views that needed 20 or 30 instance variables. And they'd actually gotten to the point where it was easier for people, like if you came in that code base and you needed to render a view, you would just instantiate everything in the controller and set all the variables, because no one had any idea which variables were actually necessary anymore. There were so many of them. And so they were way, like if you think of a teeter-totter, they were like way over here. And so at the end of the week I spent with them, they asked me for some, you know, I wanted to give them concrete advice. I don't even know if they ask, actually. I probably just inflicted it on them. And so I tried to give them some rules that would push really hard on the other side, right? I don't want you to have a 5,000-line active record model. I want you to have a 100-line active record model, right? I don't want you to pass 50 arguments. I want you to pass 3 or 4. And so I made those rules up as an antidote for a very specific bad situation. And then I went on the Ruby Rogues. And in a podcast that got way out of control, at about the hour and 29-minute mark, when I thought no one would be listening, I repeated them on the air in public. And that was like a bomb went off, you can imagine, because like we're so, like there's 5 rules in this, there's actually 6 rules, and the 6 rules that you can break any of the first 5 as long as you can get your pair to agree.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And people, why is it that we're such cargo culters about things? Like that's the rule that people forget. So anyway,
yeah,
there's where they came from.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking earlier before we started recording, we used them on a project at Thoughtbot, and we met with you after, like, maybe doing it for 3 or 4 months,
yeah,
probably.
It was long enough to get some real experience with it. Yeah, it was very helpful for me.
It was super fun. Like, it was a lot of fun, and it boiled down to, like you said, they were an antidote to, like, having many large,
yeah,
all-knowing
too many
things.
Big things.
And, like, I think you could just boil it down to make smaller things. And name more things.
Yeah.
Like, give
things
more of a proper name. Mm. And that's kind of what I took away from it. I don't follow them as rigidly on any other project.
Because why would you?
Right. If I want to have 7 lines, I'm going to have 7 lines.
If 110 lines, like, is 101 really worse than 100?
Right. Yes.
Right? It's a slippery slope. I mean, here's the thing I would say. Like, I wrote code for so many years. I don't write that much code anymore, but I wrote code every day for 35 years, for longer than many people at this conference have been alive. And one of the things that it taught me was a keen belief in my own fallibility. And so all I'm trying to do is make errors that are easy to recover from. And I find it really easy, if I make too many small things, it is really easy to put them back together. If I make too few really big things, it's really hard to break them apart. So I'm just trying to get the direction of error to be the one that's easiest to recover from. And small things is that direction.
Right, yeah.
Nobody ever complained about giving too many things explicit names.
Yeah, exactly. And the naming thing. Names are hard.
Yeah.
Right? That's one reason why we don't make small things, because you have to identify the concept and give it a name. And it's much easier. Like in my talk tomorrow, I have a thing where I send where and then some to a subclass of AREL, to an active record subclass. All right? And, like, what is that? What do I mean? What was my intention? Mm-hmm. Like, giving it a name and making it a scope in that class is really different than letting the semantics of objects that you don't own leak out all over your application.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons in relation OR, the API is it's a method on relation, and it takes another relation. Mm-hmm. And we specifically did that to optimize for named scopes. But yep. Like a side effect of it is if you're calling OR from a controller, mm-hmm. it's actually much more verbose, because it's like article.recent.or, mm-hmm. article.pinned. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And so if you want to avoid having to repeat the class uh-huh. name over and over uh-huh. again, you have to give that an explicit name.
Yeah. And, you know, it probably is a thing.
Yeah.
If it's a thing and you name it and you put a method somewhere that everybody can reach, then they'll use it.
Yeah.
And instead of having it leak out everywhere and be broken because you only change half the places when something changes. I mean, but names are hard. I mean, it's all we do, really.
Right. Yeah.
Right? It's all we do. Make up names.
Like, there's oftentimes where I identify like a thing where I'm like, I want to take this and make it, I want to break this out and give it its own, I like to think of it as like giving it its own space to mm-hmm. to become mm-hmm. what it wants to be. And I'll just stare at the empty file for a little while. Like, what am I going to call this? What am I going to name it? And so I have a lot of files named foo.rb until I come up with like what it, and then I see what the methods are on it. And I'm like, did that tell me anything? No. Okay. Okay. Thesaurus time. Like
So here's the point in the podcast where I turn the tables, right?
Okay.
Like, what are your naming strategies? That, give it a bad name. That's one strategy.
Just get a name out there. Yeah.
And so, do you have the same strategy?
No, I just sit and stare at it.
Yeah. So you don't go forward until you have some name that seems.
Oftentimes, I'll write out the type signatures of what I'm trying to do. Not necessarily. I mean, of course, if I don't name this thing, I can't use that type. But of the methods that I think are going to exist on it, I'll write out the type signatures of those, and sometimes that helps me find a good grouping.
Yeah. I mean, it's painful to get the name wrong, I feel like, but that's just a tooling thing. Like, cause you're mm-hmm. like, oh, now I've got to rename the test, and every place I called it, I've got to rename it there, and like, but I realized somewhat recently that like sitting and waiting for a name was costing me more than like I'd just rather have the wrong name and do the search and replace I need to do and rename the files.
I mean, I go both ways, right? Sometimes if I write the foo class and the bar method and put the contents in, then it's clear to mm-hmm. me.
Right.
But sometimes I just give it a name that was I thought was good enough, and then if I hate that name long enough. Like, I had an experience recently where a buddy of mine, we were writing some code, and we got together every Sunday. Every Sunday, we would, like, revisit some part of the code, and we would be unable to remember what something did. And we would talk about it, and we finally would figure out, oh, it's the thing X. And then after about a month of that, we were like, why don't we just change its name to thing X, right?
Right.
We have to reinvent the wheel every week.
So. Right. And, like, also trying to match, like, there's also a delicate balance between, like, finding the right name based on the code that exists in the class mm-hmm. and finding the name based on how you talk about it externally,
mm-hmm.
right? So, like, mm-hmm. I've been involved in a lot of projects where it's like, oh, well, you know, to our customer support people, they say order, but internally that's actually something else. And it's like, oh, you may have gotten a little cute here. Like, maybe it should just be what we call it.
Order,
right? Where it should just be what we call it externally.
Like, I have very strong opinions about that.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, just, like, let's not give it a different name. That's not going to help.
Right.
Like, those people pay the bills. Let's talk in a language that they can understand.
Right. And mm-hmm. just making sure we're mapped between, like, the external mm-hmm. names of the things in our system and the internal as much as possible. Sometimes you can't because there's, like, the external name actually represents two different concepts inside the application.
So, yeah. But sometimes we can help them. Mm-hmm. with understanding that it's two different things, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it is, I don't know. You know, now most of the code I see is other people's code because I teach classes in object-oriented design. And one of the things that I see is how hard we as a community, how much difficulty we as a community have making up names.
Right.
And I see a lot of names that are meant for other programmers, names that are geeky names about what something does that has the type in it, that talks about what happens inside the method. instead of a name that asks for a thing, that's a name that's in the domain. And so code is, it makes code really hard to understand when we write, when we name things after stuff that means something to programmers.
Right. So are you an anti-verb in class name?
Oh my gosh.
Person?
You know, they have, I spent a couple of weeks in that rabbit hole trying to read I read everything I could find from all the smart people about how to name classes. And there's a whole school of never, never slap your hand, use a verb.
Right.
But like here's the thing I think, especially in Rails apps or anything that uses a web framework. So when the request comes in from the user, right, they pressed a button on their keyboard, they're asking for a procedure.
Mm-hmm.
They want the whole thing to run, whatever it is, and the right answer to come back. Now, as that message travels down the stack, at some point in the middle, it's probably objects, right? It's things I want to reuse.
Yeah.
But the very first thing, like after the controller, if I have some sort of process manager object, it's going to be the doer of the thing, the printer or the manager or the whatever. And I am unapologetic about that.
The controller, if you will.
Exactly.
No, I mean, it's funny, right? I wish if we could go back in time in Rails, I think we would go closer to the direction Django is, where each individual action has a separate controller. Because that's effectively what we always want to do anyway.
Yeah. Right. There's very seldom overlap between, like, index is its own thing.
Right.
And then,
especially index.
Right.
Right.
You end up, and especially when you get into the world of, like, before. I can't say before filter anymore, before actions.
Mm-hmm.
When you get into the world of before actions, they only apply. They often don't apply to all the actions. Mm. At that point, you're like, well, this is weird that I have all this code here.
It's really like you end up with this lack of cohesiveness in a controller, right?
Yep.
I have all this code that does different things in different places and doesn't change at the same rate.
Right. Yeah. And really the entry point is the action. So it'd almost be better if each action had its own thing and we could share with composition instead.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite is before action only index. Why would you not just put that code in index?
What? Yeah.
Because then you'd be over five lines of code.
Yeah. That whole thing where it's like using modules, right, to pull code out to make it appear to be smaller.
Yeah.
Right? If you have a module that you pull out and you only use it in one place, then what you're saying is, well, I don't really know what my things are, and I'm not composing them. And that's exactly what happens at before action, right?
Yeah.
Is it some arbitrary rule they're trying to not violate, perhaps?
Well, it's interesting. I was having a conversation yesterday. One of the questions I was asked was, people complain about the inheritance structure of Active Record. So why don't we remove Active Record base and instead mix in a module? And it's like, I think there is still this idea that this kernel of an idea that a lot of people have that a module is somehow different than inheritance.
Yeah, it's true. Sometimes I tell people, okay, we're not going to use inheritance for that, and they say, well, how about modules?
Right. Yeah.
Like, no, it's no different. And to me, they're a little bit worse, right? Because they're a little sneakier.
Yeah.
And I want it, like, if you feel like you need to use a module, you should probably be using composition.
Right. Well, especially if you end up having class macros get called from inside modules.
Yeah.
Like things that change the behavior in really, really non-obvious ways.
There are times, though, like, especially in a Rails app where it's just like, I could try and do composition here, or I could just do the Rails thing and have a concern in the controller that does whatever.
I mean, there are places where the API does make it very hard to inject something.
Right. Yes. And I find there's like a delicate balance between, like, even if you could do something, it doesn't necessarily make it the best way to do something in a Rails app.
So,
right? So like I could do something that would be a better practice here. And the example I like to give is like rendering views, how it's kind of magical that our instance variables turn into what gets rendered in a view.
And that's some scary code in Rails.
Right. And you could avoid that by just calling, you could explicitly call render and you could pass the local variables you need. And you could do that and it wouldn't be too hard.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody else who came onto that project would instantly say, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
Look at all these lines of code. And like, it's better, I think, but
I mean, we have to define better, right?
Mm-hmm.
Better by whose lights? Better in some purely academic way?
Right. In a vacuum.
Better in terms of the amount of money it costs my business to produce software?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the only criteria that matters for me. And so, I mean, I don't know. I can distinctly remember hearing, okay, this is the only part that's distinct. I heard DHH say this in some keynote at some RailsConf, okay? But I know it was him, and I know it was a keynote, and I know it was at a RailsConf. He said something along the lines of, if you don't follow the rails away, it ought to hurt.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like something he would say.
Yeah. I mean, I swear, if we watched all the keynotes, you would find that.
Yeah.
And so here's the thing, and it's true, right? Like the framework has very strong opinions, and if you arbitrarily try to use your own opinion when it's not necessarily an obvious benefit in the behavior, it's going to hurt. You're going to write code that no one can maintain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, my life is a little non-typical for Rails because, you know, if I make money these days, I make money by teaching classes in object-oriented design. And people don't call me if they're completely happy with their code.
Same thing here.
Yep. Right? Yeah. So, well, I'm sure you guys are in that same business. Yeah. Yep. And so the apps I see are businesses that have succeeded beyond perhaps their wildest dreams with very large legacy code bases that are out of control. And what they're not Basecamp. They have lots and lots and lots of domain knowledge that really ought to be separate from the framework. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to use all the parts of the framework to arrange their code, and it's costing them money. And so what I tell those people is, like, I want their apps, I want them to do, I don't know, you know, I made up the Rails way.
Another rule?
Well, so, yeah, I made up a rule. Like, here's the thing. What does Rails want you to do, right? They want you to invoke an action on a controller, to know the name of a class, to set that class in an instance variable, mm-hmm. to send a message to it, and to send that response back to your view. And sometimes in order to do that, you have to make a bunch of your own objects and put them in the middle.
Yeah.
Right? And so I feel like I'm telling people, do what Rails intends you to do. But in the framework, like, there's not any stock place in the framework to drive the edges apart, the request and the database persistent apart.
Right.
There's no clear guidance about all the stuff you put in the middle. Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I think that's also not necessarily the place for Rails. Because a good Rails app is just a good Ruby app that uses Rails as its glue to the database and the HTTP layer.
I love Rails, right? I think that, like, how did this happen? That people have Rails apps that are hard for them to maintain, and where stuff is too big, right?
Right.
Like, if Rails wasn't such a success, such that people who didn't have to know a lot of OO could write really big apps, mm-hmm. they would probably not have big apps to complain about, right? It's a tribute to Rails in some way that these applications exist at all,
and that they lasted long enough
and
to get that.
That these businesses won in the marketplace, yeah. But it doesn't. You know, we're not excused from trying to find ways to give them advice that helps.
Right. No.
Now, just because they won, and should they have known better? Well, maybe. Did they? Well, they didn't. Like, let's get real.
Well, in Rails, like, we optimize very heavily for getting started, mm-hmm. which is unfortunate, but is what open source self-selects for right now, because that's how you optimize for adoption. And so a lot of the tools that we provide, the main thing that comes to mind are active record callbacks, can turn into a tangled mess when mm-hmm. overused.
Yeah.
And I do think that using active record callbacks for everything isn't necessarily the Rails way, but a lot of people see it as the Rails way. Like, I think that term has started to become conflated into mistakes that intermediate Rails developers make on medium to large sized apps.
Mm. I'm going
to
push back.
Okay.
Again, she's saying that it's a mistake to optimize for the entry-level Rails app. Because I don't think so. I don't even think you have to make that excuse, is all I'm saying.
Right.
Right? I think that there's a time when apps grow up to the point where they need a little more straight-up OO.
Right.
And that you can't expect the framework to help with that, and that we have failed in providing that information for people.
I think it's also that we're failing to provide the lower levels. And that's one of the things I've been trying to do inside of Active Record a lot, is give you the level right below Active Record, mm-hmm. And, you know, the framework that we use to build the framework. And probably even we'll end up going a layer or two deeper than that. But so that way you can, because, yeah, when an app gets big enough, it has its own needs, and those are going to differ from Rails' opinions. Sharding is one that comes up a lot where mm-hmm. I don't think Rails should have an opinion, because if you're at that scale, you probably have.
You better know how to do it, right?
Yeah. But we could make it easier, mm-hmm. like, to throw out the idea of a single database connection per thread without throwing out everything mm-hmm. else.
Yeah.
I think the other interesting thing to note is that this isn't a unique to Rails problem.
Right.
I've worked on lots of programming languages with lots of web frameworks, and they all have large classes. They all rely mm-hmm. too much on framework. It speaks, again, back to, like, we're still doing Rails 10 years later, so we've been talking about this for a long time. Mm-hmm. But these problems exist in Java apps. These problems exist in C# apps
in the same way. Exist in apps, right?
Yep. Like, yeah, because we haven't figured this out yet.
Well, it's hard because we can't give things good names.
Right.
It's interesting seeing it when you start to take it towards its conclusion. I mean, conclusion's the wrong word, but when you follow it out. Because Shopify, for example, our God object is shop.rb. It is a 6,000-line active record class. Mm-hmm. It mixes in 87 modules. Yeah. The first method definition starts on line 635. And there are more class macros after the third method definition.
And it's just so
exactly.
It just seems
I have
like
some
it,
rules that you might want to try following.
So, but okay. Oh boy. So here's the thing. Big things get bigger.
Yes.
That's the rule, right? The bargain we have as programmers is that you're going to put stuff where stuff like it is. And so once they reach that tipping point, it's really hard to get stuff back under control. Yeah. Like, it seems pointless to make one small thing. I mean, that feels like hiding code, right?
Right.
Like, you expected it to be there, and I stuck it off in some corner where you'll never find it.
Right.
And so getting out of that requires some sort of intention.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I can't help but think that class is costing you money.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Like, do people like working on it? Do they break it every time something changes? Does anybody understand it?
I honestly don't know.
I would guess the answer to what would they, did they, no, yes, no, what, I don't know what the answer should be, what order they would be, but I bet people hate it.
Yeah,
I bet
I'm sure.
If you look in Code Climate at the churn versus complexity chart, it's way up in the right-hand corner, right?
Right.
It's highly complex and it churns all the time.
Right.
And it's probably because, this is what I see when I go, I often ask people when I go to sites for that piece of information, show me what files change a lot versus how complex they are. Mm-hmm. And it's always, they have this beautiful curve where things that never change are really high complex, and then it falls off, and then things that change a lot are really simple. And then there'll be a few things up in the far corner. And those things are always the most important models in their app.
Right.
Because those are the things that require that we understand what we're doing, and we don't usually when we're writing them. Yeah. And then once they get up there, they just get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, absolutely.
That thing smaller.
It's the same, right, because I do open source full-time, and Active Record Base has been my main target for a while, and I can't really remove a lot of the public API methods, but I've been trying to reduce the number of, there's the tweet that was going around like 2 years ago where if you just do Active Record base.new.instanceMethods.count, it's like 600 or something.
As they say, the blast radius is large.
Yeah. Well, and that number is down. That went down in 4.2, and it's down in 5, and the Active Record gem is now actually an implementation of the data mapper pattern under the hood. And all of the methods that do have to stick around, I'm trying to turn as many of them as possible into one-liners that delegate to some other object and remove all of the private instance methods.
And so that process is exactly what happens, right? Yeah. When you figure out, oh, I wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah.
We don't get to say, shh, I'm going to close the doors and we'll do a big refactor and be back in 2 years. Like, that's not an option. And so in some ways, it's the most interesting problem left in programming. That grown-up problem of changing the tires on the car that's moving.
Mm-hmm. I think you see a reflection of the same problem when you look at teams transitioning to SOA. Because if you do it too early, it's just a complexity multiplier that can kill your business. And if you do it too late, it's almost impossible to do it well.
Aaron says he loves microservices because his method calls don't have enough latency.
Right.
You heard that joke?
Yeah. Yeah, no, we have scaling problems. How can we fix them? Let's add HTTP in the middle of all of our method calls.
I mean, I go a lot of places where they have a big architectural mess. Mm-hmm. And so they have a monolith and it's slow.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some pressure somewhere from the bottom to go to microservices. And Sarah May had a talk last year and she was bang on, right? If you can't make small objects and make them collaborate safely in a big monolith, you have no hope of making microservices work.
But I think that's why they're so popular, is because it's our reaction to the fact that we as programmers are generally very bad at enforcing the boundaries between the modules in our system. Yeah. And if you put HTTP there,
it
makes it slow and makes it painful to go across that boundary, at least.
I can distinctly remember a situation when I was still at Duke where I wanted to write a gem, basically, to build search queries in SQL. And a lot of apps needed it. And I didn't really know what I wanted, so I thought, I'll just put it in an engine, and I'll start there. Mm-hmm. But then I thought, well, I don't need an engine to start with, because I'm a good programmer. So I'll just write all the classes inside this Rails app I have, and it won't get connected to anything else. Right, it'll be easy. And when I finally sat down and tried to make it an engine, it had leaked. The semantics had leaked everywhere. It was such a pain in the ass to rip it loose from everything. And some of the problems were kind of hard.
Yeah.
And so it's just like, if we're allowed to reach into other things, we will.
Right.
It's hard not to do that.
And we also work in a language that has send and instance variable get.
Using them wisely.
Yeah.
Almost never. Yeah.
There have been a handful of cases.
Okay. So I wrote Smalltalk for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
back in the day when you didn't really have to deal with other people because there wasn't an internet. It wasn't that long ago. Don't laugh. And so I'm pretty cavalier. Like, I love sin, and I know the perfect use case for sin. I mean, like, if you, it's really nice to let the users pick different things in the user interface and mm-hmm. combine them into a method name that you dispatch.
Mm-hmm.
That's the perfect thing, and I want people to let me do that.
Right.
The alternative is a really ugly if statement.
Yep.
Well, I'm more complaining about it because you could do that with public send.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about specifically calling private methods on other objects.
Okay, I've done that too.
Yeah.
But so here's the deal, right? This is my rant about private, using the private keyword. I was using somebody's gem again, and they had a method that wasn't in the public API that I needed, mm-hmm. and they had marked it private because they didn't mean for it to be in the API, and it hadn't changed in 7 years. Okay, what does it mean to be private? Like, what are you telling me? I think you're telling me it's unstable.
Hmm. That can be one reason.
If you hide stuff from me that I need, don't blame me if I break in and use it. Now, that doesn't mean it doesn't mean you can all do it, right? But I understand that Jim, the creators of Jim, like, I'm a end of the line developer.
Right.
Right. I made gems that other people used at my shop, but there's definitely a set of concerns that you as a Rails person have, right? That
yeah.
I could play much more fast and loose with the rules.
Okay, so this actually gets into something that I've been looking for the right place to talk about it a little bit, because a lot of people don't realize, like, ARL is not part of the Rails public API. And ARL in particular has breakage almost every time there's any version of Rails released. ARL, which actually does follow Semver, but only ever has major version releases,
mm-hmm.
Has its own breakage, and interactions with Rails, you know, can break a good bit. And there's a lot of call for it to become public. And there's a lot of call for a lot of the Rails internals, because people use Rails internals all the time because we don't always provide everything people need to do their jobs. And it's not always as simple as just taking what's there and saying, okay, now this is public API, because it needs to be thought through and be something that we're confident with maintaining.
Well, it's not like what happened in the past, right? Like, we regret many of the APIs that we have now because Kent Beck said, you'll never know less than you know right now.
Right.
And mm-hmm. and that's how we live, right? And so, I mean, okay, despite the fact that I would defend to the death my right to break into your private API and use one of those messages if it hasn't changed,
right.
if it hadn't changed in 8 years, I would defend your right absolutely to be very cautious about what you release publicly.
Right. Well, and then right? it's, you know, Hopefully upgrading works. But with ARL in particular, it's interesting because I've been talking for a while about my plan to sort of phase out relation, because I think there's a lot of fundamental flaws with it as a query builder. And basically, it's mostly summed up as a relation represents, it's in set theory, right? It represents the results of a query. And that's our primary unit of composition in Rails. And I think that is the wrong level to have as our primary unit of composition. And this gets reflected a lot in why OR had to be written the way it did. And so my rough plan is to introduce all of the public APIs that relation would need to exist as a low maintenance gem. Because we're not going to do 2.3 to 3.0 again and just change the query builder and mm-hmm. everybody
that
has
hurt.
To break their apps. And so relation needs to live until the end of time.
Mm-hmm.
But that means that I need to introduce public APIs for it to exist on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And just since we were all here, we actually started to discuss how do we go about doing that? Is this a thing we wanted to do? And then it was brought up, okay, what's going to happen to ARL? Because we've been unhappy with ARL for a long time, which is why we haven't made a public API. And so we did finally decide that we are comfortable with the plan of exploring alternate query builders and phasing out relation. And if we're going to go that route, there is no reason for ARL to remain private. So in Rails 5.1, ARL will be introduced into the public API.
Cool.
Yeah.
Into a thing that's going away, yeah. But, you know.
Yeah, and that confuses me a little bit, right? So it's a thing that's going away, and yet you're going to put it in the public API.
Well, because I won't have a reason to break it anymore.
So that people will.
I mean, it will still work, right? But
yeah.
but it means that we're going to be focusing our breakage somewhere else.
Yeah, okay.
So the private versus public thing to me, like, I maintain two gems. One of them is an authentication library that I didn't write originally, and I feel the pain of almost everything being public because
yeah.
it's like I can't change any of this, right? So then when I wrote my own gem, I instead of looking at it like what needs to be public and what needs to be private, I kind of looked at it as like, what does the user want to do? What do I want the user to
yeah.
sorry, what do
yeah.
I want the user to do?
Yes.
That's public.
Yeah.
Everything else is private. Like, even if I have to jump over myself to make it happen, like, I'm just going to, because it was like, everything is a reaction to the circumstances you found yourself previously in, right? So I have probably gone too far.
Maybe the other way. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I certainly like that because it's particularly because it's a new library, right? So I don't know exactly how people are going
to
use it.
It would be like, interesting if you could tell, like, to get the stat about how many times they're breaking into private methods.
Right.
Right. That would be useful. Like, I don't think there's any way to get that piece of information unless you could have it mail home every time they called it.
Right.
I guess you could. It's Ruby. You could probably notify yourself when they invoke that method.
You know, it is one of these things where, like, when we have an API that we want to deprecate or change and we're trying to evaluate how big of a problem is that going to be, we can evaluate in the context of our apps and we have a pretty broad range there. But it's really like, we're just making a guess as to if anybody's actually using it in the way that we're breaking. Because we could do a survey, but that even that wouldn't get...
There's no way to find out, is there? Not unless you go put something in every method call that calls home when it gets invoked and then collect those stats.
Would anybody mind if we introduced phone home into every method call?
That's going to work for you, won't it?
But there's also the second class of user there, depending on what your gem is doing. Because you also have to consider the users who want to build plugins to extend what your gem is doing. That's why I always advocate for building one level of abstraction down and making that public APIs. Hmm. Like, it also becomes hard to document because you kind of want that to be in separate RDoC repository from your main API. But I think it's an important thing to have and be pleasant to use, if only because it makes it more pleasant to build the thing that you're building.
Well, that was exactly the situation I ended up in, right? Like, it was a thing that would have been in the lower level API.
Yeah.
That never changed. It was very stable on their side. Yeah. And you said a thing a minute ago, like you said you were too loose and then maybe you were stricter, you're not yet. The jury's still out, right?
Right.
Whether you're too strict, but you said I made the gem so that they could use the things I wanted them to use.
Yeah, exactly.
And that to me is a thing that's what this person did to me in this gym. Mm-hmm. And I hated it because you have no way to predict how I'll use your code.
Mm-hmm.
And the restrict, like, you I'm limited by your imagination now.
Right.
Right. We had, and like the RDoC thing is interesting because, like, we do have that second layer down, and that's specifically what I kept as private because I was like, I don't quite know. Like, it's a gem that supports creating database views in Rails, and we only support Postgres out of the box. And I knew people were going to want MySQL, and I knew I didn't want to build it.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I'm going to need to build that second layer down, but I'm not ready to say, like, I'm committing to this being, like, public API. So, like, I tagged them with extension, which is not a thing, but, like, I tagged them with RDoC that says, like, extension.
Yeah.
And so people can go, and, like, the idea being if somebody said, I want to build this on MySQL, I could say, okay, great, these are all documented.
Here are the places.
Here are the places. Yeah. It's not public API, but then I could say, like, who depends on my gem?
Right.
And I could look at how they're used. Then, like, it's a much more controlled environment because then I can say, like, oh, Scenic MySQL depends on my gem, obviously. Let's go see how they're using these classes that I built as, like, the next layer down and decide whether or not, if I'm going to break it, then I need to talk to these people and coordinate a release. Or, you know, I need to kind of come up with some sort of workaround. But.
Well, and I think that gets into, this gets into the understanding how users are using what you built. Because the question did you open an issue or a pull request to make that method public?
No, I didn't. It's been a while.
Sure.
Yeah, I suck at that. Sorry.
Because it's useful. Yeah, we don't always know.
I should have. Yeah, that's right. There's no way. And the thing I was going to say that you had me thinking of was it's that whole, like, now we're talking about the problem of communication between human beings.
Yeah. Yeah. All problems are people problems.
Yeah. And if there was some way to know, if these things, like, either we are evil and recalcitrant and in each other's way, or we mean well and we just don't know enough.
Yeah.
And if we could solve the knowing enough problem, like, all everything that we've talked about could be solved if we could just get enough information.
Yep.
But that information is really hard to get.
Well, even if we had it all, like, if I went and looked at every single person in this room's Rails app and, like, got all of the information about the specific use cases you need for your domains, I would never be able to process all of that in my head. I would explode.
Right. The core, so public-private is one thing, and I have a friend who's a Java programmer, and it drives him nuts anytime he has to use something that's marked as final, which is a thing you can do in Java where you can say, like, you can't inherit from this class. And
it's like, really, see, that's the thing. It's like, don't tell me how I might want to use your code later. Right?
But that's a conversation
that's
happening in Swift right now where they're deciding whether or not, am I making this up? They're deciding whether or not things should be final or not. Anybody? Swift programmers? Anybody?
Yeah,
okay.
I'm not sure.
Anyway.
We had a similar thing in Rust when we're adding a thing called trait specialization, and there was a big discussion around whether it was going to be virtual by default or final by default.
Right. And I think that's a discussion they were having in Swift as well. And I think they may have, like, I think they started with not final by default and then switched to final by default, which is, like, that's a language level decision. And once you make that decision, that's fine. But if you're playing in Java, where inheritance is like the thing, and then you're just like, nah, my classes are final. And it's like, well, why? Why are you making them final?
You know, in some ways, okay, I'm going to reveal my vast ignorance about this topic here. But again, I have a bias, right? I came from small talk, and I segued through Java a little bit, hated every minute of it, and then felt saved by Ruby. And so I have spent the last 20-some years writing code in languages that had enormous faith in my ability to do the right thing. And along with that enormous faith in my ability to do the right thing, they give me the freedom of everything. And I was somewhere in Sweden talking at a bar after a conference, and some statically typed guy had a little too much to drink, and he was trying to, like, I was carrying the banner for all of dynamic programming languages, right? And he wanted me to explain to him how that could possibly work. How could possibly work? And he was very adamant that it was a seriously bad idea. And I told him, you just trust people. Yeah. You just trust people. And he said, they're not trustworthy. And I said, well, they shouldn't be writing Ruby. Yeah. Like, they should write Java, right? And so that, like, I really prefer languages that will allow me to shoot myself in the foot if I do, but give me the power to do that.
I like that, too. And we have this argument inside Thoughtbot a lot because we have a lot of people who want to write, like, Haskell.
Yeah.
And that is, like, so you think Java is strongly typed or statically typed. It's not compared to Haskell or Rust. Like, Rust has strong types as well. And Sean and I have talked on the show before. Like, I'm just, for whatever reason, like, I'm just more comfortable being like, yeah, I'll give you this thing. It's kind of like this. And, you know.
It's a thing. It'll work.
I mean,
you can treat it like an array. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
I think the biggest benefit of a statically typed language is not necessarily in the compiler checking everything. That is a useful thing to have. But it's that it gives you a way to express the semantics of the types, which exist whether you're in a statically typed language or not.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the biggest problem, like, the statically typed people laugh at us in Ruby because they're like, well, you don't know what APIs your roles have to implement. Like, how do you even tell people that? Yeah, do you write, right? How do you know that you've done it? How do you know if you've broken it? It's real, like, you have to do that sort of RSpec share behavior group thing or some kind of module thing in Minitest to even document it, which I'm fine with, right? But they find it laughable that that's a thing that we even have to do. And I find it kind of laughable that I can't, like, I can't, well, you can't do it in Ruby. Can't subclass string. Can't change string? Really? How can you survive when you can't change string? Like, how can you write code in a language where you can't change the base types? That seems crazy talk.
I don't know. We've started removing most things that subclass core types. Mm. So, like, active support safe buffer no longer subclasses string. Action controller parameters no longer subclasses hash. Because usually if we're subclassing it, the behavior we want to change needs to know about mutation.
Yeah.
And we don't want to have to track every possible API change.
Gets back to the leaking out, right? It's easier for them to leak out because you don't control the entire API.
Oh, that was the thing I was going to mention earlier. Why, like, send is still a useful thing to have, because there are times that I want to make a method public because I need to call it from other objects, and it often only exists to be called from other objects. Except, so the definition of public API in Rails is documented on api.rubyonrails.org. But like, it happens once a week or so. Usually it's around ARL. I'll mention ARL's not part of a public API, and they're like, oh, well, then why is this method public visibility?
Yeah, it's like a different definition.
Right.
Yeah.
We don't have, because we don't have package visibility, and we have public and private.
It's a thing that would have been public, but I make it private because I don't want to have that discussion with people on Twitter.
I mean, in some ways, it goes back to the whole communications thing, right? Like, I want to tell, when I write code, I want to tell people what's safe to use and what's not.
Right.
That's all we care about, right? It's safe to use this and it's not. Like, I reserve, this is stable, I reserve the right to change these things.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be nice if I could have a couple of levels of instability. This is probably okay. Mm. This, you should avoid this at, you know, peril of your, right? And so if you could do that, then people would be able to choose their own level of risk, which you can't now. And that's all I want. Like, just give me all the data I need to make my own bad decisions, and I'll be responsible for them.
And when you make your bad decision, that's, you are responsible for them, and then you just back them up with copious amounts of tests so that you know when they break.
Totally.
When you upgrade the version of that dependency and something's changed or whatever.
I mean, that whole choosing your level of risk gets into like what Ember and Rust do with feature stability, and what I'm hoping to introduce to Rails in a new release cycle. Although that's a whole rabbit hole that maybe we shouldn't go down. But I agree that you should definitely be able to say, I want to opt into unstable features because I am able to tolerate the instability. I think that is a very useful thing to have, especially if you're releasing frequently.
Should we do some Q&A?
Yeah, Q&A. Anyone have questions?
Q&A. Was I warned about this?
Anybody?
Like, as I said earlier, the doors are locked, so.
Oh, surely you have some questions. Here, I'll browbeat you.
Want to ask them questions?
I could.
What's the best talk you've seen so far? What's a good, sorry, I don't want to make
talk
it.
Should, okay, what's, I just got here, yeah, okay. late
What's
last
a good
night.
Talk
What should
seen?
We see that we haven't seen that you saw?
Thank you.
Sean's talk was good. Richard Schneeman. We just came from Richard Schneeman's
Richard's
talk.
Was really
that
good.
Was really good.
Yeah. I got stuck in the hall. I couldn't get in there, but I had intended to go.
It's very yeah. entertaining.
Definitely,
very good.
Definitely I mean, watch the yeah. video of it.
Caleb's was good on Full Text Search. That was good. Oh, and you definitely have to watch Nicholas Means's keynote.
Oh,
from,
yeah.
I saw the tweets about it. I was on the runway at RDU. When that was happening.
It was so good. I watched it and I was just like simultaneously like inspired and then also like, oh, what am I doing? Like,
now we're all going to feel bad. Is that what you're telling
me? Well, it's inspiring. And then you overcome the, but yeah, it's really good. Anyway, questions. Come on, questions.
So who here's given a conference talk? Let's do that. All right. So all of you didn't raise your hand. Why not? Yeah, okay, not yet. That's a good answer. Yeah,
not yet's a good answer.
Yeah,
no,
good idea.
There you go.
That definitely counts.
Yeah, leaning into it. So, you know, if you know my name, it's because I gave a talk. It all started with a talk.
Which talk?
Gruco 2009. It was a book, a talk about the solid design principles.
Okay.
And is that how the book was born, out of basically that talk?
And no, that talk was because Adam Wesley was hounding me. Oh, my gosh.
Okay. Who was hounding you?
Okay, wait. A few more minutes. I went to the very first Rails. This is a lesson for you all. I went to the first Rails Conf in Chicago, and I went in some talk, and they were talking about something. I don't know what it was. Some nerdly object thing. And I went out, and then it was really impossible to understand. Right? And it made everybody in the audience feel stupid. Because it was one of those technical talks where people were all like, really, what is he? I wish I could leave, but I'm in the middle of this aisle, right? They were doing that. And so I went out, I was having this rant in the hall afterwards about how I hated it when people made things that seemed, like I'm not the smartest guy around, but once I get something, I truly do understand it and can explain it, right? Like that's the thing, that's the only thing I have, that once I get it, I can tell other people about it. And so I was having this rant about how unnecessarily complicated it was. And the woman who became my editor, Addison Wesley, was standing near me. And so the campaign to get the book written started then in 2005. And so that talk, every time I go to a conference, she would be there and she would buy me an expensive meal and make me feel guilty. And I would say, no, I'm not going to write a book. And so that talk actually happened because people were pushing me in that direction. And so I ended up somewhere else. I don't even remember where. And actually, okay, let me look at the... Like, I never talk about gender from stage. I never do, right? Because I want to be the change we want to see. That's what we are, right? There's a place here for everybody who's not part of the dominant culture. But at the same time, the very first time I sat on a panel, men in the audience, actually here, I'm going to enlist all the guys in here. Men in the audience came to me and they said, it is so great to see a woman on stage. I can't tell you how glad we are that you're here. And it really matters. It really matters if you, like at that first Rails conference, there were 600 people and there were 12 women. We all went to dinner together. We sat at a table like this together, all of us, all the women at that conference. And so after I sat on this panel, some guy from Gruco came up and said, we hope you'll submit to our CFP. And then I was like, oh, okay. And then at like 11:59 on the night when the CFP was closing, like it took a lot of people really encouraged me. Okay. And, you know, everything that happened since then, I am the antidote for ambition. It is true. But making a place for every, like being clear about how you want the world to look changes the world. Anyway, so that was a little rant. That can't tell anybody about that because I never talk about gender from stage.
My wife graduated from a code school in August, and I've been encouraging her to start submitting proposals to conferences. And I don't know if it got accepted, but she did finally submit one to Open Source and Feelings. But I remember, like, we were having a conversation about it, and she was very nervous because she's like, "Oh, I'm so new at these conferences I'm attending. Like, what do I have to say that anybody else wants to hear?" The thing is, that's the majority of the audience. Like, the majority mm-hmm. of the people in the audience are just like you at whatever level of, like, there's an audience for you at any level of experience, and I think everybody out there has something interesting that they could say, a story that they can tell.
I mean, if you know more now than you did 6 months ago, so there's somebody who's where you were, and you can help them by explaining it to them. I mean, it's not like you, okay, did you learn nothing? You didn't. Like, you all know more than you did. I don't know. You know, having been in both seats now for me, it's very clear that there's nothing special about this seat. I mean, the thing is being brave enough to try. And the only reason I submitted that CFP was because I knew that I would just hate myself forever. I felt like such a weenie for being afraid. And so I did it, and then they took it, and then it was like, oh, no. Like, I thought it would be enough if I just submitted to the CFP. No one would ever take a talk.
Do you still get nervous when you speak?
I don't anymore, and it is such a treat. But I'll tell you what, I was ready to throw up the first time I gave a talk.
Yeah.
Well, Aaron still, like, has a panic attack every time.
I know. I don't know how he continues to do. If I was as nervous as him, I would have long since quit.
Yeah.
So he's a really brave man.
To me, like, the thing that got me into it was, like, I still, every week we do this podcast, I'm like, what do I have to say that anybody wants to hear?
Yeah.
And the fact that people show up to listen to it live is amazing. But when I was I would go to a few conference talks, and I'd be like, I would go to talks of people that I really admired. And I would hear them say something. I'd be like, that's just like a thing I said. You know? I'd be like,
I knew that. I could have said that.
I could have said that, right? Like, I did say that last week. Like, and then it's like, oh, because they are just like me. They're where I am right now, or 6 months ago, or 6 months from now, or like whatever the case is.
So. It's not actually true. We all just have listening devices at your home and work, and we just steal all our talk ideas.
We've heard good talks.
Yeah. And it's one of the things that makes this, you know, I was at a conference that was mostly .NET. No, I was at a Ruby conference that had a guy that came from the .NET community. Mm-hmm. And he was amazed at this community. And I know there's like a drama week, right? But if you live in those other, especially the sort of more rigid, strict worlds, so I asked the guy, he was like, this is an amazing conference. And I said, tell me how. Tell me why. And he said, lightning talks? And I was like, oh, yeah, there's lightning talks. And he was like, lightning talks? I'm like, I don't understand the lightning talk thing. Like, repeating it won't help me. Like, I need more information. And he said, like, all the conferences he'd been to in the .NET world, there was, like, us and them, the people on the stage and the people in the audience. He said, the fact that you can just put your name on a board and get up and talk to people, like, what kind of world is this? This is so crazy. So there's space. There's plenty of room.
Yeah. That is one of the things, because I know that the Swift development world has other conferences, but like WWDC is sort of the epitome of the people on stage and the people in the audience. I've never quite understood, like, because that development community, it seems to be very similar in energy level to the Ruby community, and I don't know, it's just interesting.
What's the divide? Like, what, that divide is completely artificial.
Yeah,
I think in that case, like, people, the reason why people get so excited about that conference is it's their one chance to hear from the people who are going to be delivering them the next version of the thing.
Stuff.
And maybe that's different now that Swift is open source. Right?
Yeah, that's why I'm like, because they can't really do much in secret anymore, at least not on the language.
Well, they can. Just be like, splash, merge.
Right. Yeah, the open source route. All right, we're not letting you leave until somebody asks a question.
Look, oh, look, we have a question.
Saved.
You got to come up to the mic.
So the answer to your question of why I haven't submitted a talk, I did, but it wasn't a very good abstract, but a couple years ago. Is that I fear the questions.
Yeah, like, I can help with that.
I've given a talk on a gem locally in a small group, and it was fine. But even then, with people I mostly knew, I got questions like, how does this gem that you've done a day of research into interact with other things? Now here, most of the people giving talks wrote those gems. Mm-hmm. So, but even then, I've seen some really off-the-wall questions, like in the Turbolinks talk. Well, how does it interact with these other three Java or jQuery libraries that I like? And it seems almost unfair, but how do you prepare the depth you need to be ready for 10 minutes of Q&A when you're done?
You don't.
Yeah. No.
So before I gave my first talk, I was horrible. That's a really terrible, like, okay, I'm afraid I'm going to trip when I go up there. I have a whole bunch of fears. I never take a water bottle that doesn't have cap. Like, no open containers for me on stage. And but the questions is a big one, right? Because it is a place where you can maximally be revealed to be the fraud you are. Like, that's it. Q&A. And we've all been in talks where somebody wanted to show how smart they are by asking a really arcane question that can't possibly be answered, or they won't shut up. Like, they try to take the floor at the end. But, okay, so before I gave my first talk, somebody famous, I forget who because I'm terrible at attributions, I was in a talk where a person I thought knew everything took a question from the floor like that, and he looked at the guy and he did this. He said, I don't know anything about that. Perhaps we could talk offline. And he went right on to the next question. And I thought, that's a thing? Like, I can do that? Yep. And so part of it, like, you know, there's two things, right? One is, like, just say, I don't know anything about that. And it's okay. No one hates you for that. The other thing is to understand that the entire audience does not want that person to waste their time. And they're all rooting for you to move on. And so your obligation is to the larger group, not to the smaller guy. So it'll be fine. It really will.
The other strategy is if it's a 40-minute talk slot,
talk the whole time.
It's a 40-minute talk slot and you only did 30 minutes, thank you very much, everybody.
Katrina doesn't take questions. She just says, I'll take questions in the hall.
Yeah, you can do it in the hall. Like, and then if you don't know, at least it's not in front of everybody.
I mean, I put a big slide up that says questions at the end to indicate my willingness to take questions. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you can just say no to questions.
And there are some bad questions, too. Like, my favorite is the
Here's the talk I wanted to give on this topic.
That's what I was going to say. Here's the talk I wanted to give in question form.
Yeah.
So the thing is, I gave a talk in Nepal, which is my home country, and I knew people there. So I knew my audience, you know. They were my friends. They were my old colleagues. So it was really nice and to open up what I knew and to learn from them. But when I gave the same talk in Munich, I was so freaked out, you know, because I didn't know my audience. And then I also got, like, too much depressed because when I was giving the talk, people were using their phones, typing on the computer, and I thought, like, okay, maybe I'm wasting their time, you know? So how do you get over that fear, or do you have that kind of fear?
Well, yeah, but so here's the thing that I've discovered, that there are cultural differences in audiences. And somebody warned me the first time I gave a talk in Sweden, and I was very grateful for the warning because, man, that's a group of people that can sit on their hands, right? They don't laugh at your jokes. They don't, like, there was one woman who was, like, nodding and smiling, and I just latched onto her. And then later, the tweets were amazing. Like, many, many people told me how much they enjoyed the talk. It's just that they're... the way that they would naturally interact with you is different. So that's one thing, right? You have to be aware that, and they might not hate you. It might just be how they are with everybody. The other thing is that most talks these days are taped, and that this is an interesting idea. You can bomb in the room and win on the internet. And so you're given that talk for the people who are there live, but also for everybody who needs that information who's going to watch the video. And you just have to soldier on, thinking about how much they're going to enjoy it, even if nobody in the room laughs at your jokes.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
I think
it's also important just to acknowledge that, like, there are always going to be some people on their phones or on their computers, because, like, somebody saying, hey, get on stage for 40 minutes and be more entertaining than the entire internet, right? Like, you can sort of combat it a little bit by making sure you front load the really important content. But there's, at the end of the day, there's always just going to be some people who you're going to lose during the talk, and it's okay, and that's okay.
I was impressed by, I went to Caleb's talk yesterday, and at the beginning of the talk, he says, like, you know, there's going to be a lot of code on the slides here. If you guys, you know, if you're not paying attention, you're really going to miss a lot of this. So if you could please just close your laptops, that'd be great. And I was impressed by how many people actually did it. I was like, that's not going to work. And then I looked around. There were like four or five people with laptops still open. And that's their prerogative. Like, that's fine. Maybe they're taking notes. Who knows? But
they're sending great tweets out.
Right.
Could be.
Right. Ben Ornstein, our coworker, has a talk on how to talk to developers. And we'll link to that in the show notes of this episode when it comes out. But you can find it basically for searching Ben Ornstein, how to talk to developers. And he talks about, like, finding just that one person, like you talked about, the one person in the audience, and just give your talk to that one person. Like, just find somebody who's willing to be like,
Who seems engaged. Right. It helps, right? It's like so horrifying when you're up there. But the other thing is, you know, when you're up, if you haven't given a talk, here's the thing you probably don't know. Like, it seems like you're going to get up there and they're going to hate you and want to eat you, right? Like, we're a little bit hardwired when there's a lot of eyes on you to feel anxious. However, my experience, even from the very first talk, when I was so anxious, I was about to—I really, literally could have thrown up. I got up there and I could feel the goodwill of the audience. You can really feel it when you're on stage. Now, there are some exceptions. If you are unprepared, they do want to eat you. Right? If you say, oh, I just started working on my slide deck last night, I get up and leave at that point. I spend too much time on talks to spend time in a talk where the speaker's unprepared. Right. But if you work hard, if you're up there, I've seen people who are visibly shaken, where their voice is shaking, and you can just feel like everybody's leaning forward trying to help them. Yeah. And so despite how, it doesn't matter how afraid you are, if you do the work, you can feel it when you get up there, that they're grateful for your efforts. And it's comforting.
One of the things that I wasn't quite prepared for when I started speaking was that when somebody's sitting in a room and watching you on stage, they're going to have neutral human expression, which looks like the entire audience is bored, but that's just how people look in a crowd. And I remember I was telling Derek and I were talking about this afterwards, and he said, well, I was explaining, like, the room was really quiet, and he says, what did you expect, somebody just get up and shout yes in the middle of your talk? And then he gives his first talk, and exactly that happens.
Oh, that's not right.
Yeah. And that's when I was like, oh, okay. It totally did. Like, it was halfway through the presentation, and I thought it was going well, but it totally, like, once that happened, I was like, all right, that guy likes this
talk.
Yeah,
totally.
And I was like.
It's very comforting, right, to have one emotive person.
Right, yeah.
And I also have another question. So I'm from Munich. So are you planning to give any talk in Munich soon? or Germany?
There's some conference in Dusseldorf that I'm talking to some people about. But it's in like summer of 2017.
I don't know about it.
Extremely booked. You should send me email.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think
she'll come talk at your house.
Sorry. Talk sure. Right. We can meet in a coffee bar.
Thanks.
We can
a lot.
Have beer in Munich. Yeah. Thank you.
We just had to warm people up.
Yeah. that's another speaker trick too. If you want questions, very often it helps to get a friend of yours to have a question prepped. You notice what happened in here? The first person to ask a question, then it's like there's a new rule. It's a psychology thing, right? A new rule got made that the rule was you can't ask questions, and now the rule is you can. And so if you can get someone to trip that, if you want questions, the awkward part of waiting around while someone gets up the nerve to do it, you can skip that part.
Well, and it feels so much longer than it is, yeah. Right? Because it feels like it'll be, you know, the time of somebody going, is anybody else asking a question? No. Okay, I think I have a question, right? And that feels like a good 5 minutes on stage.
Mm. Eternity, really. Megan.
Hey, so I recently inherited a code base, and it's nasty. And I want to fix it so bad that it pretty much hurts.
Mm-hmm.
But I work for a small company, and I'm on a very small team, and there's not a lot of time with, you know, strict deadlines. Not only that, but there's a lot to do, so it can be daunting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if maybe you have any tips for balancing, you know, the need to better your code versus handling business need as well.
Yes, I do. All right. So I would get, okay, here's the thing. If it's a mess and you never touch the code again, you should just ignore it. And so the trick is knowing what messes are costing you money and gradually making those better. And that's that turn versus complexity plot, right? And so the next trick is, all right, I'm going to try to be efficient here. One thing that's, like, we often, okay, when confronted by the big mess, we often feel like we have to say, I don't know, you know, I have to tell someone if I'm going to do a refactoring. I have to ask for refactoring. And the other thing I would tell you is that they pay us for our judgment and that refactoring is a thing we do every day as part of every feature that happens. What our customers don't want is our velocity to gradually slow to zero. And so if every time, you know that code is going to change because it does, right? Like if you're asked to work on a feature and the code is messy right there, make it a little better and just do that every time you touch it. And I would never advocate lying to your customers or the people that pay the bills, but they are paying you to make good choices for them. And part of that is to clean up while you're there. And so do it. Just do a little bit of it all the time.
Yeah, so chiseling away makes it a lot less daunting than the...
I've seen a number of large rewrites fail. I've never seen the chisel away process fail.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. Just do it.
Last chance.
Then we go, okay, you know what's happening right now?
Happy hour.
Oh, wait, there's a question. No, we're not going to happy hour now.
So going back to the talks, fear and whatever. Mm-hmm. Suppose I'm brave. How do you choose the topic to talk about? Like a topic that everyone would like. That's my problem. Like, I don't know what to talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
If you are excited about it, they will like it.
Sure, but how do you choose the topic is, what should I talk about? What I do every day, some blog post I wrote about.
So here's a question I would ask you, right? What do you know right now that you wish your present self could tell yourself from a year ago? What have you learned that you could, like, probably some things happened that were hard for you now that your current you could have saved past you a bunch of time. Can you think of anything that you could tell your past self that would summarize your experiences over this year that would have improved your life?
Yeah, sure.
Okay,
yeah.
That's your talk.
So it's something you work every day, like.
You're not the only,
every day.
Like you're not unique. Lots and lots of people want to know the stuff you know now. Past you, there's a lot of people just like past you. That's the thing, right? We feel like, oh, nobody could possibly care. It's like lots and lots of people care. And so if you can really help, like the thing that you would do that would help past you is enormously helpful to all the people that are today in the position that past you is in. And so probably if you just make a list every day, every time you learn something, if you write it down, pretty soon you'll have a whole whiteboard full of things that are topics that other people are going to find really interesting. Mm-hmm. Do it. All right, if you're having that thought, do it. Being a speaker at conferences changes your life in ways that are really, so many ways that I won't even try to articulate them. But I think that it has made such a difference to me. I want everyone to have that experience. It's a really good thing. And there's no reason why you can't do it. You know, the difference between sitting out there and sitting up here is very small.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
You know, one of the other things, too, that I think is just important to understand when submitting talks to conferences, because that's one of the things that doesn't get a lot of coverage, is, unfortunately, getting accepted at conferences is less about being good at speaking and more about being good at writing abstracts. Eventually, once you've given enough talks, and if you're good at speaking, you start to get invitations, but it always just comes down to you have to get through the CFP process. There's some really good blog articles, especially the one written by Sarah May, which I don't remember the title of, which we'll put a link to in the show notes. But it really is about, there are so many talks that have had great abstracts and have been terrible talks. And I'm sure that there are plenty of amazing talks that got rejected because they didn't have a good abstract.
You have like 350 characters to sell yourself to strangers.
Yeah.
Like picture yourself flipping through that program as somebody going to the conference and figure out why somebody would read what you have to say and come to your talk.
Yeah.
Like what are they going to get out of it more than what you are going to tell them? And that's basically what I got out of Sarah's thing, which was excellent. And that's how I got excited. Like I wrote my first abstract, then I read Sarah's thing and I was like, oh my God,
yep.
I'm going to go back over here and rewrite this thing. So,
well, and submit it to a lot of conferences because it'll get accepted to one and rejected for 15. That's just how it ends up working.
And what I would say is make your talk on spec and give it at local user groups and tape it and submit a link to it.
Yeah.
Like conference organizers really, imagine you're a conference organizer, right? Especially a small regional one-track conference where they pick 8 or 9 talks and they try to get some, they do a blind draw. And then even once they know who the people are, they pick some strangers because they want new voices. And then imagine that one of those people shows up completely unprepared. Like, have you ever been in that talk? I have. And so you're evident. If you can give them evidence that you will be prepared, you can win based on that. But it means putting the whole talk together, even if you don't know any conference is ever going to pick it.
You learn a lot from putting your talk together.
It's good moral fiber.
Yeah. Cool. Should we wrap up?
Yes. Thanks very much, Sandy.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thanks for coming. It was great to have you on.
It was a treat.
Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/70.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes and Google Play are much appreciated.
If you have feedback about this episode or any others, you can tweet us @_bikeshed, email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm, or leave feedback on the website, or find us in the hallway.
Thanks for listening to Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming, guys. Thanks so much for coming out. That was great.
Oh, yeah. That was great. Happy to do it.